Good evening. Good to see everyone here this evening. And we're still in chapter 7, page number 24 of the lesson book. Studying chapter 7 of the book of Romans. This is the last day, almost down to the last minute of the month, isn't it? We're down to question number 10, I believe, in the lesson book. And in our discussion that we had last week, where Paul is trying to encourage us, I believe, to understand that you are separate from the law. You're married to another. You're not married to the law of Moses anymore. You're not married to the old ways. You're not married to the ways of the world. When you have become a Christian, and you are now married to Christ. And we talked about some of those things, and so this is, he uses marriage as a metaphor. Sometimes people lose the metaphor because they're trying to impress upon trying to make it all about marriage, and that's not really what it's about, even though you can draw some truths and some conclusions from that as well. So we're talking about the law, is the law sin? We was talking about that. We got down to about verse 8 in our lesson text. And so question number 10 says, when was Paul alive without the law? That's the part where somebody answers. Verses 8 and 9 say, but sin taking occasion by commandment wrought in me all manner of concupiscence. For without the law sin was dead. For I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. So when was Paul alive without the laws? Before he was taught what the law was. So he was dead. Well, we'll get into, I want to get down to question number 12, and then I want to give you a kind of a sum it up explanation and see if this helps. It says, when did he die? Was the next part of the question. He died to the law. He died to the law when he, what's that?
No. In verse 9, when the commandment came.
Yep. So in disobedience to the law, he became dead to the law.
So that was after he became a Christian?
No.
And that was when he was acknowledged, when the law acknowledged, because remember, the law points out sin. You know, I can't remember if it's this chapter or another one where it's talked about touch not, taste not, handle not. So the law tells you these things. You know, the law, and then once you know that it's wrong to do and you do it, and you do it anyways, then you have sinned under the law. And so hopefully this will make sense as we work through this. But the idea that I think he's trying to get us to understand, try to get us to see, there's a better way than the law, because the law just points out sin. And question number 11 is, how does sin take occasion by commandment to deceive us? By pointing out the sin, right? Mm-hmm. By pointing it out. That's how it does it. Question number 12 is, what was Paul's conclusion about the law itself? Verse number
12.
It's holy. The law is holy. And the commandment is holy, just and good. So even though it seems like he's saying that the law is burdensome, the law is something that is pointing out sin, and it seems like it's condemning us, at the same time, he still comes up with a conclusion. It's still good. It's still what it needs to be.
Well, we remember that the law of Moses, they could not keep it perfectly. And therefore, it was burdensome to them because they kept trying all of these things that we think of it as acts of work. It proved that works could not save some of them.
Right.
And it took grace under the law of Christ.
Right. Back to previous chapters. Yeah. I want to read to you something I think it would help us out a little bit from John Stott, on his message, the message of Romans. And he says, in answer to both questions then, Paul has declared that the culprit is not the law, which has good designs, but sin, which misuses the law. Verses 8 and 11 are closely paralleled. Both describe sin as seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment either to produce sin or to inflict death. Take a criminal today. A man is caught red-handed breaking the law. He is arrested. He's brought to trial. He's found guilty and he's sentenced to prison. He cannot blame the law for his imprisonment. True, it is the law which convicted and sentenced him, but he has no one to blame but himself and his own criminal behavior. In the similar way, Paul exonerates the law. The villain of the peace is sin. Indwelling sin, which because of its perversity, is around and provoked by the law. I'm not even sure how to say it, antinomians, who say that the whole problem is the law are quite wrong. The real problem is not the law, but sin. It is the indwelling sin which accounts for the weakness of the law, and the apostle will go to show in the next paragraph that the law cannot save us but because we cannot keep it, and we cannot keep it because of indwelling sin. And so I don't know, maybe that helped it with the understanding a little bit of the argument here that he's making. The law is good in its design, but sin is what misuses the law. It's why it's a violation of the law.
So when was Paul alive without the law?
Well, alive without the law, that means that the law of Christ was taking effect. The law of good, obedience. So that would be without sin, outside of the bounds of sin. Well, I said that it is, but as long as he was obeying the law, so you're outside the bounds of sin.
So you're saying between, conversion.
As we would view it, looking back, because you know we have the history to look at. To me, the best way to look at it is the way you're looking at it. Was under Christ, you have forgiveness. We're outside of the sin that's pointed out by the law. But under the law, back before Christ, all were guilty of sin because of the law. So that's where the death would take place, because death is separation from God, because God cannot tolerate sin. Because there is no mercy, because there is no grace under the old law, I guess maybe saying no mercy might be a little bit of a stretch, but there's not much mercy. Because the people that under the old law, whenever they broke the law, what was the penalty? For many times, death.
The law was good because God created.
Right.
And we have to remember that, and we have to remember that the purpose of the law. We is the purpose of the law for us today. And that's to teach us that it was a schoolmaster. The Hebrew letter teaches that it was a schoolmaster, which means that it bridge that Calvary takes us to the law of Christ.
That's right. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, the Old Testament, you know, talking about getting forgiveness, they had all the offerings. You know, they had the sacrifices and offerings, and they had one type of offering and another that they did constantly. And that was for their forgiveness, because when they did something wrong, and, you know, Moses would tell them to go, they had to offer something for it and everything.
Actually, it was for forgiveness, but the forgiveness was in the future. It was to stay the anger of God.
Okay.
Because the sins, the sacrifices that were offered and so forth for sin, mm-hmm. was to move it forward to a future time. Because remember, they had times that they were to sit and remember the sin. They were to bring it back to memory. And also you had you had times and certain offerings that the priest had to do on behalf of the people. Even the high priest would go into once a year to the Holy of Holies, only allowed one shot once a year, and he would go in and do that sacrifice. I like to think of it is kind of like or in the similitude as the New Testament tells us, you know, about gives us the example that where the Moses or where the snakes or the serpents come among the people. You remember the poison snakes come in, a lot of people died, and you know they were sent as a plague. It wasn't just a natural thing. And so God had Moses, when he was pleading for the people, to fashion a brazen serpent. They put him on a pole.
Everybody looked on that serpent.
That's right. Everybody looked on that serpent, was able to be healed of the affliction of being bitten. So I think of that, to me, that is a type of what we see in the Old Testament. And far as God goes, staying the anger of God. Is, you know,
well,
this... Yep.
Because that was like the sacrifice of birds. If you look at that one section where it tells what animals and when and everything, how precise it was, you know, it had to be through obedience that's how he forgave them. Like,
yes,
he had to give them something and they had to obey it.
Yes, and that's what made it an act of faith.
Right.
His faith in action. Remember who Paul is making the argument to at this time. He's making it to the Jews. They understand it's a whole lot better than we do because they lived under it. Now, many in this time frame, they lived post-Christ, so they were living under the old law when it wasn't necessary. All right, question number 13 says, read Romans 7, 13 through 25 several times, and decide which of the following men did Paul have under consideration. The first choice, A, unregenerative man in sin. B, a man under the law of Moses. C, a Christian under the law of Christ. So what did you think? Which one of the three? You put A? Okay. You don't know why? You knew that was the next question, didn't you? What anybody else put? Anybody put B? Anybody put C? Well, it's kind of like, it's one of those exercises of where if you read it, don't read it with the idea that you're trying to figure out which one of the three. Because don't be looking for that. Just read it and try to grasp what it's saying. Read it multiple times. My opinion is, I thought it was B, a man under the law of Moses, because that's what we're spending the time defending or trying to convince them of, that the law, you need to divorce yourself from the law because it's dead. Hence the metaphor. Divorce yourself, or I shouldn't say divorce, but you're dead to it because it's dead. So you are separated. You need to separate from it and come to Jesus, come to Christ, the new and better way. That was kind of my thought. Anybody else want to offer anything?
I think you're right.
Well, I don't know if I need to accept that or not, but
I don't think anybody is knowledgeable enough to debate you on that.
Well, I really wasn't thinking about a debate. I was just thinking of some additional thought. But any of those three you pick is going to be, I think, okay. You can make the argument for. Hence why he put them there like that. I thought it was a hard question.
Well, yeah. If you're right now, because you're right about the chapter 7. They're talking about limit of the law. They're talking about it. It's totally unjust. So you're right.
Question number 14. What was the purpose of the law of Moses? In fact, all the law as stated here.
I misstated the book a minute ago. I meant to say Galatians instead of Hebrew. But it was the law of Moses was the schoolmaster which brought them to the law of Christ.
Yes. I also thought about a secondary purpose. Actually, if you think about it, there's many purposes, but it all boils down to one. It's to point you to Jesus.
Yeah.
But I thought about to expose sin based on what is said in verse 13. Number 15 is define some words here. What the word spiritual from verse 14?
Relating to or affecting the human spirit or soul as opposed to material or physical events, elements.
In other words, not of this world, not of this life.
Opposite of carnal.
Huh?
Opposite of carnal.
Yep. It's not fleshly but spirit. Thayer's found in Thayer's, it says belonging to a spirit or a higher being other than man, but inferior to God. So I thought about that definition for a little bit. So, you know, an angel would be inferior to God. Man would be inferior to God. But yet we see the angels as being spiritual, right? We have a spiritual side to us. So Galatians chapter 5, verse 16 through 23, I thought helped with that line of thinking. B, verse 14, carnal.
Relating to physical, especially sexual needs and activities. I think of it as being worldly.
Both are correct in certain contexts. The Jewish, to the Jewish person, it would be things of the flesh. Also can be used to refer to a sexual nature. But from what I was understanding, this is a specific sexual nature, not a non-natural. So it would exclude bestiality, would exclude homosexuality. It would exclude all that stuff, but it would not exclude adultery as between a man and a woman. It was specifically seemed to be stated between a man and a woman. That's what made it carnal. But in this case, or in this context, I think the fleshly definition is what we're looking for, having the nature of the flesh. Because look at the argument that he's making in this context. Even though both definitions you guys gave are correct. Next page, page 25. Yes, ma'am.
You know, when I was teaching world history, the hardest thing to teach was sacred and secular. You know, sacred and secular. So would, that would fall under secular because it's of the world.
That's right. It would be.
And so when sacred is of the Heavenly Father or the Spirit.
Yep, of the Spirit.
Yes.
Yep.
But, you know, it was like, no, you know, that was a really hard concept to get across. We don't think it would be, but for some reason they had a problem with those words.
Well, you could also apply a, word left me.
Analogy?
No, I was thinking, what was I thinking? Well, anyway, it left me. It left the station. I blame it on COVID. Teflon brain just slipped right off. Culture was what I was trying to think of. In a cultural context, see, it wouldn't necessarily have to be something that's sacred to be what is venerated. Use a Catholic word, venerated, which I'm, believe it or not, I've, you know, I was hearing that word a lot in the news and describing people here lately, the venerating so-and-so and this one and that one. I've been interested in noticing that. But anyway, side point. Something that's held up or venerated, it's held up high, in that's not necessarily religious, could still fit that category. Yeah. But in our conversation, in our thinking, anytime we think of sacred things, it's nearly always religious or of God. Letter C, allow.
Give permission to do something, give the necessary time or opportunity.
Yep, that would be it. That's an old word that we would not use in that context most of the time. Let's see, I thought I had something to read to you right quick. Okay, it must be the next one. It says explain verse 17. And so verse 17 says in the KJV, now it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. So what do you think about that? In light of these last three, the last three words we defined.
No matter how hard man tries, he's not going to live in complete folly. And that's where grace comes in. And now then it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. What he wants to be, because of sin, he can't be a complete person.
Yeah, complete. Yeah, you're thinking of complete as in being able to fully do what you need to do spiritually or to please God or Christ. Yeah, very, very hard to do. Desire to do good, but fleshly desire, the carnal, takes over. We seem to give into it more than we should.
If you think about the Jews, when they left Egypt, they had the intention of serving God. But there was always something, and they were called stumbling blocks. There was always a stumbling block that got them in their way. Even though they had the best of intentions of serving God, they didn't always do that. They would, for example, they didn't completely destroy the Amalekites. They left it out.
Yep.
When Moses went up on the mount to get the Ten Commandments, when he left, they had the intention of serving God. But what happened? The golden calf. They made a golden calf. And it was always something that, even though their intentions might have been good, it was something that always tempted them. Not to.
The spirit is willing, but the flesh is
That's it. And is that? Yep. The rest of this chapter is one of the passages that, well, every time I read this, it's like, man, I can identify with this. I can identify what he's talking about.
That I would.
It's talk. It's just basically just framing the struggle of being human.
But what's interesting is that even Paul, you know.
Yeah. He said, I have trouble with this stuff. It's also what makes Romans so masterful.
And I think that's the reason, well, we don't know the reason that God included certain things in the Bible, but when you think about it, when Paul stood Peter to his face, it showed, everybody likes to say that the apostles were perfect. They didn't sin. All of this. Even though Peter had the best of intentions and should have known, because the blanket was let down, and he
preached
the first gospel sermon to the Gentiles. He understood that. He was given that privilege. And yet, what did he do when the other apostles came from Jerusalem?
Gave preferential treatment to the Jews.
Wouldn't eat with them.
With the Gentiles, yep.
Yeah.
Not to mention denying Christ three times. You know?
Well, this is well after that, what we're discussing there. Yeah.
It's human nature. It goes back to it.
Well, think about it. You know, Jesus prayed for in John 17, he prayed for the disciples, you know, that he, not to remove them from the world, but they'd be protected from the world. And so we know the worldly influence, you know, Satan's called the master of this world. We see his influence is everywhere. He's the father of lies, as John tells us. And his influence is everywhere, but that doesn't mean that God's influence is not everywhere.
Well,
part of
it helps keep us humble, you know.
Yeah.
That, I mean, people should be humble by their own self-awareness.
I kind of missed this the first trip through. Back to Romans 1. What is part of the punishment of God? Well, I'm not giving you enough information there. I'm thinking it, but you're not thinking what I'm thinking yet. In Romans 1, he talks about all the evil that people do. You know, the evilness of the Gentiles and people of the world. One of the, you know, then he talks about how that they, you know, had the debased mind. They worship the creature more than the creator. And then what does it say God did to them? He gave them up to vile affections. And so then you had the homosexuality, the bestiality, all that stuff that played into that. And then it says he just stepped back. Part of the punishment of God is us letting us do what we want to do. I missed that first trip through. And I've been thinking about that a little bit. God, part of the punishment of God is him just moving, stepping out of the way. Because people that want to say that God is not there, that God is, letting this stuff happen, he should step in and all this other stuff, making those kinds of arguments. It's not the nature of God. He doesn't want to force your hand. But he can force your hand by stepping out of the way. So that's why we're... Yeah. So right now, I believe what's going on in this nation, as he has, it seems to be stepping back, he's punishing us. He's punishing the nation by getting out of the way, letting you go to your own desires, letting you do your own thing. And it's going to end up in the fall of the nation. That's what history tells us.
Because, you know, if you do all that, just think about it. If you're not thinking about things of the sex, I mean, from the then they're going to get diseases and,
yep,
you know, with the monkey pox,
yep,
and, you know, and they're going to, and, you know, everything, if they drank too much, they're, you know, they're going to die from that.
Self-destructive.
Sin is, you know, death is the wages of sin.
Yeah.
So he's just saying, go at it, party hard.
Yep. Go at it.
He sent us Camilla and Gary.
That's well, see, that's one way God punishes. We learn from the Old Testament that He punished, that He'll also, when necessary, He'll step in and punishes nations with other nations. Think about the nation of Israel, how many times they were punished by another nation because God let it happen. He quit protecting them and let it happen, and so they were judged.
The worst thing is we read Isaiah 59:1. He separates himself from sin, separates us. And he no longer hears the prayers. And to me, that's the prayers of people asking him to intercede because of sin. In other words, they're sinning him. And he steps back and lets it flourish.
Right now, the only way to save America, so to speak, is if America repents, then he will stay his hand or put his hand of blessing back in. That's the promise. He told us that. He told them in the Old Testament, if you will do these things, repent of your sin, acknowledge me, and come back to me, I'll bless your land. You know, that's what he told the Israelites. And so if you want God's blessing, you got to come to him for it. And anyway, it's a lot of interesting thought to me, a lot of interesting thoughts there. And it all comes back to this idea of this fleshly, giving in to the fleshly desire. That's a lot of the reason he didn't want them going off is because it would corrupt the people.
So if we're like the United States and it's got all these different religions going on, you know, it's like very diverse.
Yeah, we're one of the most diverse places on the planet, to be honest. And even though they tell us we're not, but that's not true. We're very diverse and it's not a racist place, systemically. Easy to prove. But yeah, the thing is, if you want God's blessing, you got to live according to His word, His way, and do it His way, and then you receive the blessings galore. If you go back to the Old Testament, whenever you see the Israelites coming back to God, think about what happened to get them to that point. The nation fell. They were generally in captivity, and it got such harsh slavery and bondage type that they cried out to God. That's what you see every single time. They cry out to God, help us, help us. And then He sends a deliverer.
It's a pattern. We're still going.
Yep, we're still hitting that pattern. And that's what will happen to our country. It'll fall, it'll go away, and then it'll get so bad that people will finally call out to God, and then He'll send a deliverer. We got history. it's not a once and done. We've got a lot of history that tells us that. Well, let's run through these last questions here quickly. I almost feel like maybe we ought to stop and come back to it. We might last week or next week for a few minutes. And verses 18 through 20 show there is a constant battle in a Christian's life between what two forces?
God and the devil.
God and the devil. And in light of the verse 14, 15, I was thinking spirit and flesh, which would be God and the devil. Spirit and flesh. That's the two fights. As you read those verses there, it's very easy to see of where Paul just. I want to read to you a few of these verses out of the ESV because I thought it kind of helped the understanding a little bit. He says, "For I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. And now if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it is good. And now that it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is in my flesh, for I have a desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil that I do not want is what I keep on doing. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me." And then verse 24 and 25. "Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then I myself serve the law of God with my mind, but my flesh I serve the law of sin." Question number 18 is, what does Paul cry out in despair? Put verse 24. "Who shall deliver me from the body of this death?" Then question 19, who brought this deliverance? Jesus, God through Jesus Christ. God, I thank God through Jesus Christ, verse 25, our Lord. Notice there's a period there. Some translations have an exclamation point there. He's making a statement. This is it. This is how it happened. And then question 20, read verse 25b carefully. Does it teach that a man can serve God with his spirit while serving with his body? It says, think. Romans 6:12 is already stated. Let not sin therefore reign in your mortal, I think that's supposed to be mortal body instead of mental body there. 1 Corinthians 6:19-20 states that we are to glorify God in your body and in your spirit. Another misspelling there. We live only if we, through the Spirit, to mortify the deeds of the body, Romans 8 and verse 13. So in light of these statements, plus what we read in the last part of verse 25, what do you think? Does it teach you can serve the Spirit while serving the body? Yes or no?
No.
It does not teach that. It seems that you might be able to pull that from that there, but remember what we're discussing in the chapter, where he says, "So then I myself serve the law of God with my mind, but my flesh I serve the law of sin." Why does the flesh serve the law of sin?
Because the flesh gives in to things that are contrary to what God wants.
That's it. Because the sin of the flesh gives in to the way of sin. Look at the verses we just read. That we just read, where he's making that plea, that argument that I want to do good, but I just don't do it. My mind says I need to do good, but then I just, for some reason, I can't make myself do it.
It sounds like that somebody's addicted, like somebody's on drugs. You know, so many times, well, if you talk to them, you know, then they'll say, "No, I don't want to do it anymore. I want to get clean. But I just, you know, it's just so hard. I can't do it. It's impossible."
Well, if you think about it, we're addicted to sin, right? The ways of this world. There are times where we're asked to give up the things of this life, but we just don't want to because we like it. like the baby in the dirty diaper that don't want you to change. It's warm, it's squishy, and I like it. I know, that painted a great image right there. Sometimes we like filth that much in the eyes of God.
We haven't come down this road yet, but what man does with the body, he likes certain things, do certain things, and he thinks he's being spiritually minded if he asks God to accept what God has said don't do. For example, homosexuality. But man today is, and they're even churches that will not preach against homosexuality. They accept it. Or other things that God has specifically said don't do.
Yeah.
And don't get yourself involved in. And we think that if we can ask God, God please accept this, he'll say, okay.
I think a lot of people do think that. I really do. Yeah. And remember we've seen it, what, mentioned two or three times last couple of chapters where somebody, you know, where the statement is made, God forbid, in regards to doing things in order to sinful things to receive more grace. Paul's like, no, that's not the way it works.
But today, it amazes me the things that people do and think it's okay. And then they'll make some reference to the Bible to justify it.